Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm the Big Mike, Mike Zlotnik. Today it is my pleasure and a privilege. Welcome, Fernando Angelucci. Hi, Fernando.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on the podcast. We interacted in a couple of places. We interacted through the Collective Genius. We also interacted through Scott Marcel Storage Academy.
Right, the mastermind.
The mastermind, right. He runs a couple of places, a couple of things, Academy and the mastermind. Mm-hmm. That's right. So you're coming to us from the Windy City, Chicago, Illinois.
Yeah. It actually was pretty cold, but now starting to finally warm up. It looks like we're going to hit the 60s this week.
Yeah, I think I certainly need a break from the cold weather. Been to Chicago, and it gets pretty cold. And anyway, so let's talk a little bit about what you do. And you're a specialist in self-storage. Where do you invest? Do you invest in Midwest primarily, or other regions outside of Midwest?
Yeah, so we have two tranches. So we focus on 8 states, about to be 9 states in the Midwest. That's because we have a funding partner that gives us 30-year fixed commercial leverage, fully amortized. And that's a 20% down loan. So we prioritize the states that they lend in first. Then outside of those 8 states, we have another 20 states that are the lowest tax states in the United States. We found that because self-storage, when you're looking at the total expense ratio, because there's not a lot of, you know, tenants, toilets, trash, utilities, your major expenses are property taxes. So the easiest way to control that is by choosing what municipalities you invest in.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was going to ask you, why self-storage? I had other guests, actually had Scott Myers, I think, on the podcast earlier, and you obviously know Scott. But in your opinion, why self-storage? Obviously, no tenants and toilets.
Yes.
What else? Well, what else do you like about self-storage?
So there's a few things that I really like about it. The first one is that it's an extremely recession-tolerant asset. So when you look between 2007 and 2009, there was a survey done by the National Association of REITs. They found that during that span of the recession, the S&P 500 dropped 22%. But what people don't talk about is that multifamily and single family on the REIT level dropped 7%. Self-storage as a whole only dropped 3.8% during that time. On the flip side, most people assume, okay, if it's a safer asset, then it must have lower returns as well. What we found is that's also not true. So when you look at between 1994 to 2017, again, this is another study by the National Association of REITs, the average annual return of the S&P 500 was only 7.5%. Multifamily did a little bit better, and so did residential at 13%. But then when you look at self-storage, and that's including the 2007 to 2009 recession periods, it returned an average annual return of 17.43%. So it has very mitigated downside risk. It has extremely the ceilings are extremely high as far as the types of profits that you can make. Just to put that into dollar figures for everyone, if you invested $100,000 in 1994, in 2017, that $100,000 would be a little over four. It'd be $4,026,000.
In a good self-storage development, the fund?
That was across. So that survey was done across the national REITs.
Gotcha. I guess that specialize in self-storage.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, they always say that, hey, if REITs can return these types of levels, usually someone that's able to be a little bit more flexible and move a little faster, they can beat the REIT's returns.
That's right. That's why we are also in the space. That's the reason.
Exactly.
This is a great opportunistic asset class, and it certainly does have defensive characteristics within a recessionary environment, which we are possibly entering soon, but you know, you never know. Will the run can continue.
So, man, the writing's already in the wall over here in Chicago, Mike. Just looking over the last year, we've already seen the derivative has become negative. Pricing is starting to slow down. I think this 2019 spring year, we're going to see a peak in prices, and then we're already going to start to see some drops. Certain niche pockets have already started to experience drops, like the luxury homeowner market. We've already started to see stalls, large days on market increases, list price to sales price disparities. So I think it's well on its way here. I think we're going to feel the worst of it sometime around 2021. 22 will probably be the best time to start picking up properties again. So what we're doing with a lot of our investors is that I'm telling my investors not to invest right now and to actually pool their cash, because in the next couple of years, there's going to be a lot of opportunities, not only in the self-storage specifically, but then in these adaptive reuse style models where, say, a big, you know, big box store goes out of business, or a warehouse owner has to, you know, foreclose or go into bankruptcy. Those are great opportunities for a self-storage investor to pick up those properties, have an existing shell that's in good condition with all the mechanicals, and then just build in self-storage. That way you can really drop your build cost. And, you know, when we're looking at their adaptive reuse, we're trying to hit $20 to $30 per square foot as a purchase price, depending on the age of the mechanicals and if we have to do any type of modifications. We're also looking for these larger clear heights. So if you have a clear height of 24 feet or above, then you could put in a mezzanine level and double your net rentable square footage. So I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities coming up here in the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, and I like how you call it. I just call it redevelopment, but you're using a little different term.
Yeah.
The concept is the same. It's big box retailers that don't do well in the recessionary environment, especially, you know, given the overall pattern of Amazon kind of the eating everybody's lunch. And then you have the combination of just local recession. You certainly could have a whole lot more vacancy in these type of locations and redevelopment opportunities. So I agree with you. This is a land of opportunity if you know what to look for. The key question is, one of my kind of, you know, observations, it's been a lot of fresh development in the self-storage space. So this pattern is not new. There's been redevelopment happening for a number of years at this point. You have ground-ups, and then you have redevelopments that have been kind of hitting, because the sector has been attractive, and
right,
a lot of my money has poured into the sector.
As soon as Forbes magazine and Money magazine started to cover this, all of a sudden it became a sexy asset, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's now mom and pop investors are running into the space. They're trying to educate themselves. There's a lot of money flowing beyond the REITs. And besides the money, there's also a lot of, let's just call them, entry-level developers who don't know what they're doing, but
right,
trying to get into this developer status, raise money from other people. Sort of one fool finds a project and more fools put the money in the project.
And I think that's an opportunity for us more sophisticated self-storage investors. You know, one of the types of lists that we like to pull is we always pull the SBA loans as well as the CMBS loans. Anything that's going to have some type of balloon on it. You know, there's a lot of investors that they get caught because they think they know what they're doing, and then all of a sudden they can't get the right contractor, so they're behind on schedule. I was talking to an owner the other day. She had a 7A loan, a SBA 7A loan, where her rate is now up to like 9%, and she's losing about $3,500 a month on her facility. So she called me to ask, you know, is there a way that we can buy the property, maybe do some type of creative seller finance so that she can get out from underneath it. Same thing with the CMBS loans. You have these 5 and 10 year balloons where these guys, they thought, you know, especially on the development side of things, they thought, hey, I can get this thing up to 90% occupancy before that 5 years. And then either some type of catastrophic life event happened, or they didn't watch their numbers correctly, or they just, maybe the market became saturated. I see this happen a lot where developers start adding units or building brand new facilities, and all of a sudden at the same time you have two other facilities going up in your trade area, and now what you thought was a 5, you know, net rentable square foot per capita index number is now a 9, and or will be a nine once all the facilities are completed. And now you're stuck with, you can't lease up. And the lease up schedule you gave to the bank that says you're going to break even in 30 to 36 months no longer applies. You're going to have to start giving rent concessions to compete. And all of a sudden, you can't cover debt service.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I like this opportunistic kind of, let's call it vulture investing. I hate to use the term, but from you know, one person's problems, another person's opportunity. But coming, yeah, go ahead.
The way that I look at it, it's not really vulture. I mean, you're solving a problem for them. Yes, they're in a terrible situation. They're going to have to give away some equity, but it's going to be better than them losing all their equity through a foreclosure and then having a mark on their record, having to bankrupt their company. I look at it as we're problem solvers.
Yeah, agreed. I meant this as a joke. I absolutely understand. You're actually delivering a ton of value. You're helping them.
Right.
They got into a bad project based on feasibility study that didn't work out and lease up schedule that didn't work out. It's funny how a lot of developers just put the feasibility study in front of you and just point to the consultant and say, listen, there's a lot of risk involved and the consultant knows what he's doing. And if the consultant is a little bit off, then the developers don't know what to do. But I'm in agreement with you that they're coming into a number of these projects that have started at a good location but have not run through the life cycle. It's the operator. Think about this right. way. Self-storage business is an operator-driven business. Great operators make much better returns than average operators. It's efficiency of the facility, it's marketing, it's everything else combined, and taking over projects that are in a good location, with a good facility, but they're not, they need more time, they're running out of capital. That's the land of opportunity. So I certainly like the idea. When you do find projects like that, give me a call. Let's,
absolutely.
Let's see if we can put together some bigger capital and then take over some of these opportunities. It is very true that these projects have kind of what do they say? The road to hell is paved to by great intentions. So right. These folks have great intentions. They have a great plan, but they wind up in a hell because they just can't execute the way they were hoping. So I'm in agreement with you that that's actually an area of opportunity that you got to keep your eyes very open and see what's happening in your local area, especially if you've been thinking about developing something. Is there something else you could pick up? Because yeah, somebody else is just failing.
The nice thing about the self-storage industry, it's extremely fragmented market. And what I mean by that is, you know, only 18% of the facilities in the U.S. are owned by the six large REITs.
Right.
The next 100 operators account for only the next 8% of facilities owned. That means that there's 74% of facilities that are owned by these, quote, mom and pop operators that, you know, they may be running this as a second source of income. It's not their primary business. They maybe had additional land that somebody convinced them to build this on, you know, mid to late 80s, and it's just been floating along. These are huge opportunities on existing facilities to do these value add properties. We just purchased one about seven or eight months ago. The facility was 100% occupied. The owner had built the facility 30 years ago, and his kind of model was, hey, you know, whatever your rent is when you come in, that's what your rent is going to be for life. So we found across the board that we had about a 40% below market rental rate on top of the fact that he did no marketing. There was no internet presence. There was no way to find him on Google. And just by implementing a website, a little bit of SEO, and then ways for the tenants to pay other than by a physical check or cash, we were able to increase the production of that property by 60%.
How many doors?
It's a small facility.
How many square feet?
Yeah, it's a small facility. It's 133 units. No office, first generation style facility.
Right, right. So what you just pointed out is that there's a universe of potentially great return on investment opportunities in the mom and pop space. They're small facilities. They don't have economy of scale for any kind of big operator. And a lot of these facilities are under performing for the simple reason that the, just like you mentioned, the original owner or the current owner hasn't raised rents for a long time. Right. And it's funny how you started 100% occupancy and no marketing.
Right.
the reason for this is because the rents are way below the market.
Right.
It's a no brainer. At this point, it is, in many ways, I don't like the 100% occupancy because the upside is very limited. But at the same time, if it's 40% below the market rates, there's your upside.
Yeah. In addition, we have room to build about another 100 units on there. So we're actually going to be getting an appraisal here in a few months during the spring market. And then we're going to be doing a cash out refinance and pulling as much leverage out as possible to build the additional units. That was one of those deals that I got with that one lending partner I have in the Midwest.
Yep.
That loan, we put 20% down, and that 20% down was just using free and clear multifamily as the down payment. We got, I believe, like a 5.25% interest rate, 30-year fixed, fully amortized.
It's certainly a great loan. It makes sense if you have a good lender relationship and they got problem situations, or not even problem situations, but somehow connection to the seller, you may get some of these little jewels. I don't know how else to pull them. These type of facilities are not necessarily what I don't like about them. On the other hand, I do like the ROI, but what I don't like is the return on time. They usually
right.
a lot of work for small actual cash flow, but on the relative basis, they generate strong returns. So I get it. And combined with expansion plan, that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So what do you think your next steps? Obviously sitting on cash now makes sense. Just don't do anything. Wait for the opportunities. But you know, that theory doesn't hold too well in the because you just don't know when the recession is going to hit. You don't know to
right.
what extent it's going to hit. You almost have to be very proactive finding deals today that you can improve, just like this one.
Right. So specifically when I bring up this strategy, I tell this to just general investors. So investors that are investing in not only self storage, but, or maybe they're not investing in self storage at all, but they're investing in stocks, bonds, residential real estate, multifamily. We're still doing a lot of deals in the self storage space because there's still a lot of money to be made. But you see in the residential, especially the residential rental market, so large apartment buildings and, portfolios of single family homes, even individual single family homes, cap rates are compressing extremely right now. And I think it's a mix between a few things, you know, us having, very high consumer confidence, the market being in a great place, you know, the recession was, 10 plus years ago. I also think there is an influx of these, I don't want to use this term derogatorily, but these newbie investors that, you know, they take a class here, they go to a 3-day session there, and then they're coming in, and the easiest asset to get into is these small single family homes and small multifamily homes. And they're not buying at the right prices, driving price up and putting downward pressure on the cap rates.
Well, that's a general pattern. The yield compression or the cap rate compression. So I've been around for the last however many years, it has happened as a result of the interest rates being so low,
right?
And then the influx of dumb and dumber money. I use this term. I really can't find a better term. I mean,
it's
this
with all respect.
Yeah, they just don't know what they're doing. They went to a seminar and then they hear a wonderful idea and they're throwing money at this. There's also been foreign capital and so on floating in, and they're paying top price. But on a small scale, it's irrelevant. On a big scale, all that's competing with institutional money. And ultimately, you need the niche. You need the niche as an operator. In the niche, as somebody who deserves capital to generate strong returns, even in a market where everybody else is generating pretty low yield.
So. Right. And we have kind of two strategies that run in tandem. So the first one we already talked about, which is buying existing facilities. Usually these are first and second generation that are value add opportunities. The second strategy that we have that's running in tandem is we are building a large portfolio where we actually find the land develop REIT grade class A facilities, usually 85,000 plus net rentable square feet. And then we will either, we have three exit strategies. The first, which is the fastest capital, is to sell them a certificate of occupancy to some of these REITs. Those types of deals are drying up and the cap rates are starting to move up a little bit. But we're still getting offers on our properties that we're building before they're even done, before we even have certificate of occupancy.
Can you give me an example of what are you seeing today on a facility like this?
Yeah, so we're almost done building this 596 unit facility. It's in the exurbs of the Chicago market. We've already gotten we haven't gotten any offers from the six major REITs, but we have some of these intermediary REITs and private equity funds that aggregate properties. They're making us offers. So that one, they're looking at about an 8.25% cap rate on 30-year projected pro forma.
Well, that's a pretty high cap rate, 8.2 versus 6.5. So everyone has been thinking, hey, big REIT comes in, offers a 6.5% cap rate, but you're not getting that.
Yeah, you're not going to get that at certificate of occupancy. The second strategy, which is the one that we really like, is build the facility and then do the entire lease up. Get it to about 90% stabilization. From shovels in the ground to 90%, we're around 48 months. Those deals, you can command a 6 to 6.5% cap rate depending on the location. If you're in a primary market with a Class A facility, I've seen some deals move as low as 5.5%. I don't like to assume that. So we're always assuming a 6 to 6.5% in our primary markets with our Class A facilities. Secondary markets are still doing pretty good, though. You're seeing 6.5% cap rates on regrade facilities moving as well. Marcus and Millichap, they have awesome studies that they put out every year, and their self-storage team is robust. I think they have a group of like 20 analysts that work on these deals, and they've been putting out amazing content. So I'm very bullish on the development side, but the one caveat that we have is when we develop, we don't develop with the end-all, be-all being selling to a REIT at 90% occupancy. Our actual goal is to do what Life Storage did, and is to start creating a portfolio of ground up Class A facilities. As you know, in the beginning, you have to sell a few of them to, you know, reintroduce capital. However, once you start building the facilities that are cash flowing, that cash flow starts compounding very quickly. And just from the cash flow alone, you can start building additional facilities, even without leverage. And then at some point, take it to the market, IPO the company, and that's our main strategy, our 15-year goal.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, that's the good old own your investments forever type of strategy, right? Getting into high quality projects. But it is this phase of the cycle, starting ground up facility, and we're looking into some. We've invested into some, and I have to say that the more I think about it now, I'm not questioning the strategy in general, because you're creating something that's worth, to use an example, you could be all in for $9 million and upon certificate of occupancy, it could be worth $13, $14
million. Right.
So you're creating instant upside through the work. But if you can't exit it, or you can exit it well enough, it's a speculative project. You may have to take it to a lease up, and hopefully you won't have another competitor breaking ground in your space right after you broke the ground.
Right.
So these type of projects in this phase of the economic cycles are speculative. Overall, they probably still make good economic sense, but I do like conversions a little more. Because of the lower cost per square foot, and you can wind up in a great location without having to buy a lot of raw land in the middle of a city. So if you can do a conversion at a great spot, I think that strategy is a little bit more better risk profile. Acquisitions of the conversions type of assets and existing facilities. The ground ups, they're certainly great. But if you mistime them and the competition comes in and you have a significant facility with limited liquidity to manage. So that's one of the risks. I'm not saying anything negative other than...
I think, and I don't think it's about...
Long horizon. I looked at a couple of fresh projects recently, and I can tell you it's no cash flow for 3 years. Conversions generally have a whole lot faster timeline because the conversion takes less time.
And I think the important thing to realize is not just to do one or none of the strategies, is to do a combination of all of them, because then you have, you know, you're walking into instant cash flow with the existing facilities. You have intermediate term cash flow coming in from the adaptive reuse or the conversions. And I really like those projects as well, because usually the locations that they're in are high traffic, you know, very high vehicle per day count. And they're usually near dense residential, because usually you're looking at these big box stores that are coming down. So the traffic is already very high. And usually these malls and strip centers that where you'd find these big box stores, they're located in places that are very easily accessible to dense residential, if not right next to the highway.
That's right. That's exactly why conversions work very well, because they've already been built in a good location. For some reason, they're just failing, not because of the location, but because of the type of product that they deliver. It's old Sears or old Macy's or old Toys R Us or any of these kind of obsolete business models. So not necessarily completely obsolete, but kind of aging business models. Then the location is still great. So,
yeah.
And then combining, I would agree with you that having diversified strategy can make a big difference if you have a lot of capital deployed across many of these. And we do that on a fund level. We have investments in four facilities, and they're all different facilities. We have ground ups, we have redevelopments. The one thing that I haven't yet found, but we would love to find a strong one, is a existing facility acquisition with expansion. I had one pretty nice project and it didn't work out. It didn't close essentially. Yeah. But existing facility in a good location with strong cash flow from day one, with expansion plans on land right next door, is more attractive from my perspective today, because it's less speculative. It's essentially you have known cash flow today. And even if the expansion goes slower than expected, you're not likely to be in financial trouble as long as the existing one is generating pretty good returns.
The issues that I've seen with those types of facilities is that they truly are far, you know, few and far between. And then when they do come, usually the seller will immediately bring them to market. We buy a majority of our facilities off market through our direct mail campaigns. Those types of facilities we found is they do become available, but when they become available, they go straight to
pricing war.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden the REITs come in and they have the money falling out of their pockets. They can't even spend it fast enough. They'll beat you every time. It's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, it comes down to finding a relationship with the owner, building a relationship with the owner, so that they're not only motivated by pure ideal price.
Right. I think the off-market strategy is key. If that's one of the avenues one of your listeners would like to take, you really have to create a in-depth marketing approach, you know, direct marketing, social media, whatever you can do to get in front of these people before a REIT get there, establish a relationship, have that trust built and that rapport. And that way it's not really about price. It's about, hey, legacy of their facility, right? You're going to take care of their baby.
I agree with you, and it's a good old real estate 101, actually shaking hands and meeting them and spending time with them and getting on friendly terms with them. I happen to agree that works very well, especially folks are, you know, they're ready to retire. If they feel, if you click with them, you don't have to be playing golf with them. But if somehow you're able to connect with them on a personal level, whatever that is, helping them with their, you know, kids or something like that, or grandkids, maybe that can make a big difference. And you build, it's the real estate 101. If they know, like, and trust you, they'll probably sell you the facility with seller financing and good terms instead of putting it in the market and maximizing their sales price. So,
right.
Yeah, the stuff that's in the market is brutally competitive today. I would not, from an economic cycle perspective, trying to find deals on the market is extremely hard. It's just almost not worth even going through the process. There are people who spend their time and energy analyzing deals and coming with low-ball offers, but the rate on conversion or rate of success on those is fairly low. So that's pretty heavy lifting in this environment. There are different market conditions when you could pick up stuff, you know, easy hanging fruit. We used to be there, but it well built, you know, we were well past that, and it's all off the market, or it's not even worth wasting your time trying to find deals. So I agree with you. This has been great. I appreciate your thoughts. Any kind of final comments? How would people find you? What's the best way to get a hold of you if they have any questions? If they, want to just learn from you or communicate with you in any way? Is that a good way to get
a hold of you? I'm an open book. So I usually give out my cell phone number to people. It's 630-408-8090. That is my true number. You can call or text me anytime. Another way to reach out is to go to our website, www.titanwealthgroup.com. You can find us on social media at the same handle, Titan Wealth Group or Titan Wealth. We're all over the place. We're pretty active out there. Just shout out. You have any questions? You want to talk about deals? You know, you have some money? Just give us a call.
Yeah, sounds good, Fernando. I appreciate your thoughts here, Titan Wealth Group, and we should chat when you have a deal. I'd love to certainly explore investing in some of your deals.
The two we have right now are ground up developments. We have another one that's coming up here pretty soon. I'll keep you fresh in mind. I'll see you in March as well.
Yeah, see you at CGU next week, and then let's regroup offline. So I appreciate your thoughts.
Thanks, Mike.
Ciao.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's slot name. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.